Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Diversity Hires. And this week, we're going to take it to the real experienced, I dare I call him a master, but the OG, one of the OGs of the screenwriting life, and particularly the Black screenwriting life, Mr. Alan McElroy. And this is big because this is our first time really having somebody with this level of experience. He's my former coworker, colleague, and as I'll talk about, a huge, huge gift giver, and received one of the best gifts ever from this guy. But yeah, I'm excited to get into it today. Sherman, what do you think?
I can't wait, man. And this is one of our first times talking to somebody who got their start in movies, somebody who started as a screenwriter as opposed to a TV writer. So I really want to hear about the screenwriting game, the movie game, swap stories, and let's get into it, bro.
Cue the music.
Yo. The Diversity Hires, back once again, a podcast where Sherman Hsu shoot the shit about screenwriting.
We are two professional screenwriters and television writers living and working in Los Angeles, and we come here every week to give you the lowdown on the screenwriting business, the craft, and the culture of writing while Black, which is basically just like writing with a, you know, unique twist. I'm Shakri Tillman, a.k.a. Hsu.
I keep computers putin'. You know who it is. The greatest screenwriter of all time, Sherman Payne. Did you catch that? Hsu, did you catch that reference?
Well, you keep... Yeah, I didn't catch a reference. No, do you want to reveal it to the people?
I keep computers putin' is a famous Cameron bar.
Yeah, you love Cameron.
Listen... I don't know, man. Just in terms of aesthetic, vibe, representing. You know, we talked a little bit about this with Zahir about Allen Iverson, sort of representing a time and a place and an aesthetic. Yeah. Cameron, early 2000s, mid 2000s, New York. It just doesn't get better than that. He just captures the whole feel of it.
If there was an excuse to bring Cameron on the show, I think you would try to find it. He does create like a visual language and storytelling, like many rappers do. I'm a big fan of using rap as an influence to write screenplays, but you know, he's one of them. Could you find a way to get him on the show? Would you have him on the show?
Yes, I would rename the podcast the Cameron Podcast, the Dipset Podcast. We just wouldn't even talk about screenwriting. We just talk about like wearing size 5XL. American flag printed leather jackets. What? And, you know what I mean? Like that's what we would be talking about.
What a time that was. What a time to be alive. What a 5XL time.
Amazing.
That was when that became the thing to just wear oversized. I mean, huge oversized and often blank.
Oversized. The blank white tee. But then you also have the loud printed like leather jackets. Like who needs loud printed leather jackets? I don't know. I remember I was dating my girlfriend. And this is sort of in the late 2000s. And she looked at me and she was like, baby, your pants are too baggy. And I was like, oh, it's the end of an era. Look, I have to get rid of the baggy pants are gone now. Okay, cool. I guess I never went tight jeans. You know,
a hard right turn to tight. I mean, yeah. it really went from super baggy to like tight in a matter of like 2 years. And it just turned.
Skin tight, like leggings. I never went that far, but then I did start wearing jeans that actually fit me.
Yes, that's where I am. In my 40s, I'm at just fit well.
Yeah. My wife went through that. She would only let me wear skinny jeans. I was like, why are you doing this to me? This is torture. If I tried to like slip into a regular pair of jeans, she'd look at me like I was nuts. She's like, why are you wearing those baggy jeans? I'm like, they fit. They're not baggy.
They're just regular.
Yeah.
Regular fit. That's right.
Sure, we should, you know what, since we're just having a great conversation, and we should just introduce our guest now, just bring him into the convo, and let's just rock the whole episode. Go ahead.
I love it. I love it. This is, I'm going to let you intro yourself also, Alan, but Alan McElroy is with us today. Alan's career spans a long time, going back to writing movies, and I read a little bit about your story, wanting to be a novelist at first, I believe, and coming out from Cleveland, Ohio to LA, writing in from what I understand, the studio system of in some kind of way, while that was still happening, and writing movies, and then having this sort of up and down career that brought you back to television or into television in this new wave of TV, and really a genre writer primarily. Sci-fi horror, dude wrote Spawn, right? Am I correct?
Yep.
That's the famous one that like people of my age, like really are like, oh, that's that guy. Yeah, that's that guy. Welcome, Alan.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Great to have you.
Thank you. I mean, I wish I could sound as cool as you guys sound on podcasts. You guys are just the coolest.
Dude, we are in deep trouble as a society if we are the cool guy.
deep
Something
trouble.
Has really failed in this world. Hey, but you know what? Ohio boys in the building. Like, we're repping right now. I've had to endure Shakri talking about Philadelphia sports with other people. And now here we are, me and Alan representing for the Buckeye State.
That's right. That's right. Cleveland all the way.
So is Cleveland like in a like sports or culture war with Cincinnati, or is that of the same? These are the cities I know.
Cleveland is in a sports and cultural war with the whole planet.
Cleveland versus everybody.
Cleveland versus the world. Cleveland versus Pittsburgh. Cleveland versus Baltimore. Cleveland versus Cincinnati. Yes.
Cleveland versus Lake Erie. We're against everybody, bro. No, I actually spent a lot of my upbringing in the Cincinnati area. We should at some point start talking about screenwriting. But Cleveland, you know, Cleveland, especially in football, man, they're divisional rivals, man. So Cleveland versus Cincy is real. And then now that they have interleague play in baseball, that goes down to the battle for Ohio. So Cleveland versus everybody for sure.
Yep.
This feels like an especially loose episode today. So where do you want to go, Shu? I'll let you lead the way.
Let's take it this way, Alan, because usually we start off and we kind of like, you know, talk through some current event stuff and then get into, but I think I want to change it up a little bit. Because we could talk about some current event stuff as it comes up in your story. Okay. But I just want to talk about, can you just talk about how you got into the business? How did you discover screenwriting and find your way in? We always love breaking in stories.
Yeah, I mean, long, long ago in a galaxy far, far away, that was me, back in Cleveland. When I was a kid, I wanted to be an astronaut. That was what I was going to do. I mean, I grew up in an era of the beginning of the space program, and I loved it. I would actually take a tape recorder, put it beside my television, and record the mission control launches, and they would take all day. And I would run 8 hours of tape listening to the launches before they would, you know, before the Apollo launches. I loved it so much. I grew up watching Lost in Space, and I went out in the driveway when I was 5 years old, promised myself one day I would get into space, and wanted to be an engineer. I didn't want to be an engineer. I just wanted to be an astronaut. My dad said, become an engineer. So I spent all my time thinking about it. Then instead of paying attention in math class, I was writing stories about what it was going to be like to get into outer space.
Right.
So then I thought, well, I'd have to join the Air Force. But turns out I was extremely nearsighted. Couldn't be a pilot, couldn't be a navigator. So, but all through all that time, I was writing stories. And one day my parents, who had tried to get me interested in all kinds of different things, from karate to hockey to, you know, I mean, I'm weird, you know, weird sports, music, but they bought me a typewriter. And my mother always talks about how I took that typewriter upstairs into my room and didn't come out for like 3 days. I just started writing stories. And I thought, I'm going to be a novelist. I thought maybe I'll be a novelist someday. And I would handwrite stories when I was in Cleveland in middle school, in junior high school. And people would get a hold of those stories and actually pass them around the classroom. you know, but I didn't, I mean, it, ultimately I thought, oh, I'll write novels. When I was, when I got married, I had, I actually wrote a novel, before I got married, I wrote a novel in high school for my senior project. Everybody else was going to their dad's law firm, going to, you know, work at some company or business. I stayed at home and wrote a novel. And my, I remember my, advisor said, she thought he's going to go home and watch TV for 6 weeks. And I came in the following Thursday with three chapters. And I think she hugged me for 10 minutes. By the end of that, by the end of that summer, I finished the novel and I thought, okay, try and publish this novel. And it took me 7 months to get my first rejection letter. And I realized, well, I can't make a living doing this. So I actually went to a convention and I came across two scripts. One was Bill Lancaster's draft of The Thing. And another was actually a Star Trek script, but that really didn't help. But the Bill Lancaster script with that and a magazine article from Writer's Digest about literally how to set your tabs on your typewriter for screenwriting format. I taught myself to write screenplays.
Wow.
And I wrote a script. Had just gotten married. I was 5.5 months married. My wife and I decided to move to LA, packed up everything in our little, our one car, which was a Toyota Celica, drove cross country. And we had like $2,000. We thought we were rich. Came to LA and I gave myself 2 years to get an agent. Luckily I got an agent in 6 weeks, not a great agent, but I got an agent. And then, not long after that, actually my wife who was working in a restaurant met, I can't remember the actor's name now. I feel bad. Really great actor. It'll come to me later, but okay. A guy who said, who basically told me to go to the Columbia Pictures writing program. And he put in a good word for me, put in this, program.
He was just a customer in the restaurant and he put in a word for just based on knowing your wife at work.
Yeah. My wife was like, my wife is very endearing. When you ever meet her, she everybody's her best friend 5 minutes after they meet her. That's how she is. And, it'll drive me crazy. It's a black actor. He was in 2010. And if I can remember his name, it'll come back to me. But he then put in his word for me with this guy who was an executive at Columbia. And I was able to go onto the Columbia lot, pitch stories, get a sense of what that meant. And from there, I actually went and had a meeting with an executive from Geffen Films. We had dinner and I pitched him like 9 different ideas of mine. And none of them, really worked out. And we were literally going out to the parking lot to get our cars. I pitched him a one-liner for a story. It was one man chasing another man through a dying man's mind. That was literally the line I pitched him. He stopped me. He said, I want you to work that out. Come back in and pitch that. I did. And that was my first development deal. It was at Geffen Films. And from then, that was in 87. And I've been working professionally ever since.
Wow. That's amazing. That's
a mind-blowing story. Yeah.
Can I ask one question about that?
Yeah.
You said that the actor put in a good word for you for a program. Can you talk a little bit about what that program was?
Yeah, it was the Columbia Pictures Writing Program. And I believe it probably was meant for young black writers or diverse writers to come in and, people who wouldn't otherwise have a chance to come in and get their feet wet and get to understand what it meant to pitch a story, meet with a creative executive. Basically what it's going to take to get in the business. And so he taught me writing outlines, pitching stories. It just gave me a chance to kind of understand, what the language was when you start off. And that, I didn't realize how invaluable that was at the time, but it really helped. It made a huge, huge difference for me.
Well, that's interesting because, sure, it's something we talk about in our ongoing Diversity Watch 2020. But, Alan, what year was this?
That was
86, 87, somewhere in there?
Yeah, 86, probably. 86, probably 85, 86.
For for 35 years, there have been diversity programs.
Programs, yeah.
In Hollywood. Exactly. And we're still only 5% of the screenwriters for film or whatever the number is.
In 2020, I believe it's, yeah.
Like if you were born in that year when a young Alan stumbled onto the Columbia lot and there were diversity programs and you're now 35 trying to write a script, you may be toiling under the same percentage of Black screenwriters that existed back then. But I really am glad, Alan, that it worked out for you.
Well, one of the things I always taught myself, I told myself, at least when I was first starting off, that's the name of the actor. James McEachin was the guy. When I was first starting off, I told myself, when you're writing, you basically nobody can tell the color of your skin from the page. And so I always thought about that. It's like, you know, let the word speak for myself. Let the word speak for me. I always figured, you know, no one's going to judge me from that. And, you know, I always felt back then that original screenplays and storytelling would be, you know, the industry runs on original ideas. Actors have to wait for stories. Directors have to wait. But a writer could always write something original and create his own work.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which has changed since then, since now that we're in the landscape of IP, we're in the landscape of, you know, it's got to be based on pre-existing material. An original idea, sadly, today doesn't fly. That's what's really sad. It's horrible.
I've definitely noticed that shift happen even further during the course of my career, Alan, you know, which is not as long as yours, but obviously. But, you know, I've seen the rise of Marvel. You know, I've seen the idea that every single thing needs to be based in IP and it has to start a franchise. If it's not based in IP and it can't be 10 movies, why even try to write it?
Yeah.
I would even say, Sherman, that it's even gotten to the point, I don't even know, it's just like a reflex now, I think. I don't know that development executives or studios are even thinking necessarily in terms of the tempo or in terms of like a multi. It's just, if you want to have a just regular ass drama, it needs to be based on a novel or needs to be based on for what reason, no one knows.
It's weird. Sometimes I'll go into a meeting and I'll have an idea and they'll go, oh, is that based on an article?
Yeah.
No, it's not. It's based on an actual idea that I had in the shower 3 weeks ago that I've been thinking about. Like, who cares if it's based on an article or not? Do you like the idea?
Right. And to the point that they will even try to backdoor, like if you have an original idea. Yep. Well, can we find an article that's similar to that we can say it is based on that? For what reason? God knows why. I don't know.
I remember the most painful thing I ever heard when I had a script, went in, executives liked it, everybody read it, everybody thought it was great, but they weren't going to buy it. And all they said to me was, well, this is just a good story well told. And I was just like, what does that even mean? I mean, isn't that what you want?
Nope. Nope, that's not what they want.
Apparently not. So you get to LA, you have this, kind of have this break-in moment. You go through this program, you have this break-in moment. Can you just describe for us, you know, a little bit of a history lesson, I guess, like what was the state of sort of being a working Black screenwriter at that time in the late 80s, where you often, I imagine, sort of the only person in a room, the only Black person in a room, or what were those experiences like? And or was it not like that for you?
No, that was exactly what it was like. But I was used to that. I was always trying to trail, you know, what they call it back in the day, pioneering. I was always pioneering. You know, I would get into programs that were where I was like the only Black person in that program. I did something called when I was in high school, the experiment in international living, where you could go and, you know, live in a foreign country for the summer, and they would pick. They picked like 170 people to, you know, kids, you know, 16 years old and whatnot to do that. And it was me and it was like one other Black kid out of 170 people. I went to a private school because I went on my middle school, my junior high school was a pretty rough inner city school called Alexander Hamilton. And they had a great program called Major Work for advanced placement, but the school itself was a little bit rough. And I think I was on my road to, if I had stayed at Hamilton and continued, I probably would have ended up, you know, in prison somewhere. Cause you know, my friends and I would sit around all day and plot things like how do you rob an armored car? Cause we were smart. We were using it for evil though. But, But, you know, and I went to a small private school where there was only a handful of blacks in that school. So I was always like that guy. And so it didn't frighten me at all to be like the only black person in a situation. But you're right. Those early days, it was just me going to meetings. It's just me. When I sold my first movie, you know, which was, I was gonna say Halloween 4 was my first feature film, but I also did a movie. I did two TV movies for USA Cable the first year they started. I had the fourth made for TV movie at USA. I was always the only black person on the set, you know, only black person in a meeting. There were no creative executives that were black. It was years before I go into a meeting and there'd be another creative executive in there who was black. But the crazy thing was they were usually the hardest on me. It's like if I walked into a meeting and it was an executive in there, and he was black, he was always like the one who would go, well, you know, I'm not sure I really get this idea, because if he felt like he had to be harder on me to prove something to his bosses, like not showing favoritism to me. So that was always kind of tough. Dude,
Shukri and I talk about this offline. We have experienced the same thing in the industry today. And I think it's because, you know, they don't want to perceive, they don't want their coworkers or their bosses to perceive that they have given somebody a shot just because they're black, or they've given somebody a pass just because they're black. So they really want to make you jump through those hoops so that they can prove that, you know, they did their due diligence. They did their job. They're not being easy on, it's a sad state of affairs that people feel like they have to do that, but I don't think it's left the industry at all.
No, I don't either. And I, pardon me if I've said this on the podcast before, and this is a repeat, but I think that, like, you know, we really need to get a development executive or two or three on here. I don't know what they, you know, what their conversations are behind closed doors. I'm just the guy going in the pitch and trying to understand, you know, why they want something or don't want something. But from my perspective, I always feel like the person of color or the black person, diverse person, whatever, that's brought into a company, like, I feel like it's part of their job. And I don't think it's a bad thing. It's part of their job to look out for, doesn't mean have to be easy on, but look out for black creators and black projects. Like, it's not necessary. And I can understand the dichotomy and the weirdness that goes into feeling like that, being in that position. Mm-hmm. But I think, like, the double-edged sword of it is certainly a double-edged sword, but the positive end of the double-edged sword is, like, I think companies, studios, production companies, whatever, bring people in because they want curators for that content. And so it's part of your job to identify the good black stuff that's out there, and that there should be no shame attached to that. You know what I mean? There should be no sort of, I got to be hard on this. It should be quite the opposite, in my opinion.
Yep. Yeah.
So is it okay if I move us forward, Sherman?
Mm-hmm.
You got other? Okay.
No, I'm engaged and engrossed in the story, and I really am eager to hear, like, okay, so it's going great in filmmaking. How does Alan make the transition to television? I'm very, very curious about that transition. I don't know if I'm jumping too far ahead, but I'm an engaged listener. I want to see where it goes.
Yeah, you're not. I mean, I always wanted to work in television. That was the thing. I mean, I always did. When I was a kid, they had the TV Guide, and we'd get the TV Guide, and in the fall, you'd get the TV Guide sneak preview edition. Mm-hmm. And it was always really thick. And you'd open it up, and inside would be, like, you know, a two-page spread of every new television show. There'd be, like, the half-page picture of the cast, the log line, and what the show was going to be. And I loved getting that, because I would tell myself, one day it's going to be my show. And so I always wanted to work in TV. Features was just, in a way, kind of a way in that direction. But when we had our daughter and my son, when they were little, I had to make a decision. Were we going to raise our kids in Los Angeles, or would it be better to raise them in Cleveland, close to my parents when they were alive, my wife's mother and grandmother, my sister, basically family, also to have a house with some property and just give them a normal life if we could. So we made the choice to move back to Cleveland, which meant that the idea of working in television, and I had a chance, because I actually I'd sold a couple pilots that didn't go forward, but then I was actually offered a chance to work on Deep Space Nine, and I chose to turn it down because I just couldn't reconcile spending 9 months in Los Angeles away from my kids. So
can I ask you to drill,
continue working in features?
Can I ask you to drill down on that feeling? Because I feel like a lot of people, we talked about this on a previous episode, Shu, about sort of how geography plays into our careers. And what was the feeling like when you had a chance to work on Star Trek? It seemed like you were a young kid who was obsessed with space and sci-fi, and you made the very reasonable decision to be with your family instead. What did you feel at that time?
It wasn't a hard choice. I mean, I really did not want to be away from my family. I did not want to be away from my kids. I still, at that time, I had a thriving feature career. I was making a good living doing development. Mm-hmm. So making that choice, it wasn't that difficult. I lamented it because I always felt like, the chance to work on Star Trek was a huge opportunity. To work on Deep Space Nine would have been a huge opportunity. And what got me the most wasn't so much that I, turned down the opportunity. It was that I didn't realize at that moment that Benjamin Sisko, the character played by Avery Brooks, was black. When I read, when they gave me the Bible and they gave me all the material, I had no idea. And when I realized I was missing an opportunity to write a black lead character in a science fiction series, that really hurt.
I can only imagine. Shu, you, sir, have talked about your plan to one day move out of the city of Los Angeles for family reasons. Do you have anything to say about this whole line of the story?
I'll just say that as a family person, I understand. And look, all I can say is that I understand the notion of leaving Los Angeles to begin with. That really resonates with me, to sort of have a quote normal upbringing, or at least just to be around other family. I think that's mm-hmm. huge. And making that decision as a person, a lot of people have to make that decision in our business. And a lot of people do things like, I've talked a bit about when I first started, I was bi-coastal for 2 years, and I know Alan has a little bit of that story. I'm sure we'll get to it. But geography is huge. And you have to make some family decisions, but I'm going to be out, man. Watch. I'm out.
We'll see.
I'm out.
We'll see.
Well, the good thing is, I mean, not the good thing, but what has been exposed by this time in the pandemic is that we can do our work on Zoom. We can do our work remote. Yeah. Yes. We can write and produce television shows remotely. And it's going to open up the world for a lot of writers that can't come to LA or can't afford to move to LA. So you've got some kid in Philadelphia or some kid in Baltimore, guess what? He's a great storyteller, but would never have the means or opportunity to move to Los Angeles. But he's got a laptop, and we can get, that person will get an opportunity to write. I think that's great. And I think it's going to be hard to see companies go back to the way things were. Maybe they will, but once they've got that money in their pocket, which is, guess what? They're not spending $50,000 a month renting office space for writers.
Thank you.
They're not going to go back to that. They're just not.
Exactly. Exactly. Look, and when I create my next show and my host my writer's room on Zoom while I'm sitting in Delaware in my gigantic house that costs like a fraction of a house in Los Angeles, then I'm going to hire that kid, exactly like you said, from Mississippi, mm-hmm. who wants to be a writer's assistant, and he can sit on Zoom. He or she can sit on Zoom. And I can hire that writer who nobody's heard of as a staff writer from Minnesota, and that person can be on my staff. You know what I mean? I think there are huge advantages to opening the world in that way and to opening our workspace in that way.
Yeah, we're going to get stories that we didn't have the opportunity to get before. We're going to hear new voices that we didn't hear before. I think it's going to be great. It's going to be great for the industry. It's going to be great for television, because television is now taking the space that cinema used to hold. Telling stories that you couldn't normally hear. I mean, TV's become far more cinematic, which is why I love it. I love it. I mean, moving away from the episodic procedural into the cinematic, where you're telling basically a 10 chapter movie. I think is going to be great for everybody.
Well, I want to get back to your story, because I think this is going well in terms of, like, just following your line allows us to sort of, like, you know, dip off into other subjects and stuff too. So let's just keep going along it. So you turned down this job at Star Trek, and I imagine that, you know, you said you were having a robust feature writing career at that time. Did that continue? Was there, you know, a stop? Did that dry up? What happened next?
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, as through my career, you know, I mean, I probably, one of the things for me is that I probably didn't realize how fortunate I was. I mean, I give it all up to God, because, I mean, my prayers are really answered. I had no idea what the odds were. I wrote Halloween 4 when I was 20. I wrote it when I was 27. It came out the day after my 28th birthday. And wow. That was my first feature film. And I had no idea. I mean, it's just like, oh, writing movies. This is fun. You know, I remember with my wife going we were in Westwood to go to the Avco Westwood, and walking up to the box office. And my wife said, "You should tell me you wrote the movie." And I'm like, oh, okay. So I said, "Hey," because there was a line, and I mentioned it, and the manager came out, and he was walking, and I remember walking. We were walking behind him because we were like, "Where's he going?" And he went through this door, and we followed him through the door, and he came around to this other door. And then you look back and realize we were behind him. And he goes, "Oh, I'm sorry. I was opening the other door for you." And I was like, oh, my. Oh, my gosh. So, yeah, I mean, that. And it's funny because Halloween 4 is the one movie that people will, like, email me about all the time. I don't know why that movie is – people love it so much. But anyway.
Wow.
I had had – so I did that. But, yes, I'd had a really, you know, fortunate career in features. A lot of the stuff that got made – I wasn't the happiest with a lot of the stuff that I had that died in development that are probably the things I'm the proudest of, and yet they never got to go forward. But wrote an action, you know, wrote Rapid Fire, got to work with Brandon Lee, you know, which was amazing, you know, got to work on Spawn, you know, go to ILM, you know, a dream for a kid who loved CGI and science fiction, you know, wrote the, mm-hmm. you know, Spawn on HBO, did all that. But the thing that was always frustrating is that you write material and then it's always being changed by director. You know, someone gets their hands on it, director, you know, some studio script doctor. It was always frustrating that very little of what you write really sometimes makes it to the screen in the version that you saw it. And that was always daunting. And then, you know, I had a movie that was just, I don't even talk about how terrible it is. I had a terrible film experience that I always have to deal with. And it was this horrible, horrible movie that Warner Brothers made, and they completely took it apart, remade it, had it rewritten. The director turned out to be somebody who actually didn't know how to direct, and it really sort of broke my heart. And for years after that, I sort of, like you, Sherman, I was thinking, you know, do I really want to do this anymore? Do I want to, you know, write movies? Mm-hmm. And then in 2008, when that strike happened, movies changed completely, because up until 2008, I could always have three projects going because of development. You know, producers had development deals, and they were always, they had discretionary funds they needed to spend. So you could always go in and pitch something, and they buy it, and you're making money off of that. Well, in 2008, after that strike, the studios basically cleaned house, kicked all the producers out onto the street. So now, anytime you go into a meeting with a producer, he would be trying to get you to write something on spec. You know, if you write it on spec, we'll get this actor. If you write it on spec, we'll get this director, and then we'll sell it. And you can't make a living like that. So I was on that. Yeah, I was almost.
I want to interject and say that, you know, I started my career after that. And even early on, as just somebody in my 20s, I always felt like that was such a bum deal. And I've said it on here before, but it's like, I didn't know anything about screenwriting business. I wasn't very savvy. I'm still not. But I was less savvy than I am now. And it just always felt like a bum deal. I always felt like, you guys are really taking advantage of me. You're really taking advantage of my work. You're really taking advantage of my time. why would I spend the weeks and months that it takes to write a script for free with no guarantee that I will ever get any money? And you've invested 30 minutes to talk to me about my idea, my draft, but I've invested all day, every day for several weeks. If people are still trying to do that, and I know that they are, I just, you know, you got to use your own discretion and decide what projects you're going to take on. But I'd be very, very wary of a producer who says, just write it and we'll sell it.
Yep. And it wasn't just small time producers, it's big producers who were, you know, they have no more discretionary funds and they're just trying to get a writer to, you know, do free work. And then the actual deals got worse, where you ended up with these one-step deals where people would go in and they'd get, well, you get one draft to write and that was it. Then you'd be out the door. So, and then that one draft, they would be trying to get you to write like 5, 6, 7 different versions because they said, well, you only get one bite of the apple. So right. You want to be, you know, it's got to be perfect because, you know, so-and-so is only going to, you know, once they read it, that's the draft they're going to read and make a decision on. So you take whatever you made or whatever they're paying you, you amortize it across the amount of time you're investing. By the time you look at what you probably put in, you're probably making minimum wage hourly based on the amount of time you've invested in the work. But
This is speaking to me so much. I know that I'm interrupting, but it's speaking to me so much because you can, as a young writer, fool yourself into thinking like, you've sort of made a good financial deal. Oh my God, they're paying me $75,000. Oh my God. But then when you look at how much time you spend on it and how much free writing you're doing and how much redrafting you're doing and how long it sometimes takes for them to get back to you in between drafts. And all of a sudden you've been working on the same project for a whole year. You've had to pay enormous amounts of taxes. You've had to pay all your reps. And you've been putting in day and night work, it does not add up to like what would be the equivalent of a $75,000 per year job. It just doesn't add up.
A whole year is, I mean, that's, you know, you're being kind, a whole year. Yeah. I mean, how about a year and a half, 2 years?
Honestly, that's more likely.
That's what I saw from 2008 to 2016, how the industry really kind of, for features, really dried up. And it was free work. And multiple drafts and no more discretionary funds. And really finding those three projects that used to be easy to find and kind of keep that in rotation because you're doing one project, you're on deck for a second project and you're either looking for or you've just got the ball rolling on a third. You just keep that was how I made a living. You just kept that ball rolling. And that stopped after 2008. Trying to get one project was tough.
Can you just, history lesson for me, like, because, right, that was before I broke in, before Sherman broke in, but we, you know, we knew of it. But can you explain, like, why did the strike have that effect?
I think, you know, the studios had just, every time, you know, writers try to, we try to kind of push for you know, a little more power, a little more control. I mean, I don't know the underlying politics of it all, but I just know that the studios decided to clean house. And it was just strange to see how it happened. All those producers that I used to go on the lot to meet with, they all had offices. They all were on the lots. They got pushed out in 6 months, all of them. And it was one of the strangest things I remember hearing is Disney, I think right around that time, said, we are out of the original movie business. And it seemed like, how could you even make how could you do that? But they made a decision to just start moving, only use their material. That's when they made Pirates of the Caribbean. And everybody thought, well, that's insane. You're making a movie based on a ride. And then of course it made, it
took off.
Yeah, it took off. And so then everybody started following that line, digging into their own library, forget about original ideas and just start pulling IP. And then it was weird to see how it went from, like the middle class of movies died. They used to, studios used to live, you know, their bread and butter was, yes, at Christmas or in the summer, they'd have a blockbuster or tentpole movie. But, you know, through the course of the year, you had movies made for $20 million, $30 million, $40 million. The middle class of movies kind of kept them going. Well, they stopped making those movies. And once that middle class died, then you had people either making movies on, you know, using their own credit cards and making a movie for, you know, $1 million, or the studios were making movies for what they are now, like 90, 100, $150 million. And that's now just become the norm. You know, when that's the norm, that's five screenwriters that are getting hired to write those $150 million movies. And the rest of us were sort of on the street scrounging and trying to make a living. And that's kind of when, you know, then that led to television taking off, because a lot of those TV producers had to turn to television, and a lot of those writers turned to television. And so you ended up with TV becoming cinematic, because all those filmmakers moved into television. And so for people who wrote features, TV almost became a natural progression. And I really feel like I'm lucky. I'm very glad that I actually did wait and start in 2016. And it was funny, because I was really on the edge. I was really ready to call it quits, just move, you know, stay in Cleveland. Maybe I would teach. I don't know. I'd do something, but I was just, you know, done with films, because it was just, I had written a movie for a NASCAR movie that didn't go forward, but I'd done like, I don't know how many dozens of drafts of that script, and it didn't go forward. I wrote a movie for Fox, but the same thing didn't go forward after dozens of drafts. And I was just like, I'm not doing this anymore. Well, luckily, you know, my manager asked me to take this one meeting. He said, you know, would I be interested in writing on Vampire Diaries? Because I said, you know, I've always wanted to create a TV show, but I knew I needed to know the ground floor of doing television. And there was a guy who wanted me to write a pilot, or I could go on staff. And what was funny is my daughter had watched Vampire Diaries, and she would always come running. I'd never watched the show. She'd come running in and say, "Dad, you got to see the scene from Vampire Diaries." And, you know, I would sit down with her, because I love my daughter, and she would want to show me these scenes, and it was great. Now, they were always really good. And so when I went in and met with Julie Plec, you know, met with them at Vampire Diaries, I mentioned
shout out Julie Plec. We're all Julie Plec. Yeah. We're all Julie Plec proteges in a way. We've all worked for Julie, and she's great. Shout out
to Julie. Shout out to Julie. That
she is amazing.
That is the one thing, interesting thing, the three of us have in common. We have all worked for Julie. So shout out.
Life changing.
Julie's coaching tree is going to be crazy one day.
It really is. Yeah. It really is.
That it made all the difference. I went on to Vampire Diaries, and it was just because I'd never worked on staff, I'd never collaborated on a screenplay. I mean, I thought, can I even do this? Will I be able to do it? And it was the greatest blessing I've had, is that stepping into the world of staffing, working with Julie, working with you, Shu, working with everybody on that staff was just, it gave me back my joy of writing. And it's been great.
That's amazing. Can you talk about, because I've had a similar transition. Can you, Shu, you've pretty much always worked in television as a writer, but can you talk a little bit about your transition from movies to television? Because they are close cousins, but they're not, you know, directly related. So can you talk about how that transition worked for you craft-wise?
Craft-wise,
what was tough, probably the toughest part, I will say, for me was paring scripts down, because I'm, you know, naturally, you know, I can write 120 page script. It's you have a certain way of writing that lends itself to more to extended scenes, and how you pace out a story so that it spans, you know, those pages. And you can't do that in television. It's, you know, 50 pages, 55 pages, sometimes 48 pages. So I would write, being honest here today, I think my first draft, when I was first given a script, and my first draft for my very first script for Vampire Diaries might have been 94 pages.
Similar experience, man. It's hard. It's really hard. You write your first draft and you're like, oh my God, I have to cut 40 pages from this draft.
I know. It's crazy. I mean, you do it. But I will say the biggest positive, the greatest aspect of it is when you're a feature writer, you sit alone in a room with your brain and you come up with your stories, you work on your own and you figure stuff out. I loved, and I think it's what's great, is to be in a room with a bunch of, you know, a group of creative people all pulling the train in the same direction, all trying to come up with great stories. You know, it's just, there's nothing like it, because how people, they think differently than you do, and they bring something that you never would have thought of, and that makes it better. And everybody's got those pieces, and you just, you become a, you know, you're a sponge just soaking up all this creativity. You're in a room full of like-minded people talking story. That is what you love as a writer. And that's what I love. And I didn't realize how much I was like a guy in the desert who finally found water. That's what it felt like for me. It was just a great experience.
Go ahead, Joe.
I just so relate to that feeling. I mean, the first time I ended up in a room after trying for, you know, many years, I've talked about it on the show before. The first time I sat down, I had gotten the job, sat down on my first day in a room with five other people, and I had to really do my best to not cry, because it felt like I was overwhelmed by this feeling of everything in my, I've had a ton of jobs, you know, I've worked shitty job after shitty job, shoe store, construction job, postman, whatever, editing reality shows, you name it. And I had never had an opportunity to sort of utilize my creative skills and the things I like to do creatively with other people, which is also what I like to do, to be with other people and to sit and to be paid for it and to sit in that chair and have that experience like, oh my God, this is happening. Like that, it was I totally relate to what Alan's saying, because it's a sort of mind blowing thing of feeling like a sense of home, a feeling like, oh, this is where I'm meant to be.
Man, I have to say, guys, I'm not on the same page as you guys. It's, you know what?
That was coming.
Listen, I do love certain aspects of the social side of television writing. It is very satisfying. But then I can't wait to be alone. I can't wait to just be in a dark, cavernous office by myself, with the only light in the room is my laptop screen, and it's just me versus the blank page with nobody to interfere.
Yeah, but when you go off to write a script, I mean, the thing I like about television writing, first of all, I think there's a continuum, because I think as you gain more, for me, I can only speak for myself, as you go along, you know, along in your career, you know, there are certain aspects of being in a room that are kind of like, oh my God, I mean, can we move on? You know what I mean? For sure.
Yes.
It definitely happens. No question about that. But I think part of the good thing is that it can be, depending on the room and how it's run, but it can be kind of a hybrid. And I think those are the best, where you do have your group time. You do try to figure out the story together. But at a certain point, it's your episode, and you got to go sit down at the computer and figure this shit out. You know, everything's not figured out for you. You have to craft this thing yourself. So no, there is a little bit of both.
Yeah, it's a fine balance. If the room is striking the balance, and most of my rooms have, honestly, at some point, you know, during the course, and there's always sort of different balances during the course of the season, right? When you start a show, you're in the room a lot. And as the show progresses and moves into production and people are off writing scripts, you're in the room less and less, and you do get that balance. But it's a fine balance, man, and it can very easily, it never, for me personally, it never tips too far towards time alone to work, but it sometimes does tip too far towards, like, man, we've been in this room every day, all day, for weeks with the same people, and we're actually just spinning our wheel.
Yeah, that happens. That happens. It does. So, Alan, so you come on to the Vampire Diaries. That's your first, you know, television experience. You have that experience. You were in Cleveland, and did you move? And sort of like take us up to now and what you're doing now.
Yeah, my kids were, you know, they're grown. I don't know. I won't call them adults, but they're grown. and I was able to move out and start working, writing full time out here. And little by little, you know, trying to get my family moved out here. But in the process, I was working on Vampire Diaries. I did the last season on that show. It was a great experience. Moved from there to a broadcast show called The Night Shift, which was a medical show. I'd never written a medical show. That was a crazy, fun experience. Just coming up with wild medical ideas. It was almost like science fiction in a way. From there, I went to a show that was a Blumhouse produced show on Facebook called Sacred Lies. And that was a half hour drama. So that was a different type of writing, but also again, just a great new experience, learning how to pare down story, you know, not be precious, really lock down characters. I mean, again, just learning. I was always learning. That's one thing I've tried to do through my entire career is always be paying attention and learning and growing. From there, went to Star Trek Discovery, which was, again, after not being on Deep Space Nine and then getting the opportunity to do Star Trek again was amazing. That, again, that's like I always say, I hit my knees and give it up to God, because that is there's 500 shows out there. I could have been on any show, but that an opportunity to go on to Star Trek, a show that I grew up watching, a show that influenced me as a writer, and to be able to come back to that has been a dream for me. I worked on that. I did season 2 and season 3 on there. Then during the hiatus, I wrote a movie. It's a reboot of Wrong Turn, one of the movies that I did years ago. We've done a reboot of that. I wrote that. Then did 10 weeks on Jack Ryan, which was a fantastic experience just to get to do that. And then back for this the fourth season on Star Trek Discovery. And what's been great through this entire process, I actually, right before the pandemic, was in the showrunner training program, which was also
great.
So that's been great, because I want to create a show. I want to, you know, I've been blessed that when I went on to Vampire Diaries, you know, in this, I mean, that's seven seasons of television in 4 years. And now I'm a co-EP on Star Trek. And I mean, that's, to me, it's just been what a journey. And I know that my next step will be, you know, my own show, and I've got things in development, but I know that's the next step and I can't wait. It's just been, a resurgence of creativity, a wonderful adventure. And it's given me back, as I said, it's given me back my love of writing, my love of creativity, my love of creating. And I think television is the landscape for writing. I don't want to see that lost. Television has been a great landscape for writers. I don't want to see it, you know, for surrender to directors. We should always be driving television. And, you know, this is, I don't think there's been a greater time for that level of creativity than today.
Please say that with a loud megaphone, that do not let television become film and become a director's medium. This is a writer's medium. It needs to stay driven by writers. I know that the film people want to come over and try to make it a director's medium. It is not. Y'all can stay in film. Anyway, that's a separate thing, but I want to make that point.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. I wanted to make one observation.
Go ahead.
Me and you both are moving through our television careers all wrong. In the past couple weeks, we talked to Courtney and B, and we also talked to your man, Alan, here. How have they done so many seasons of television? And we have done so few seasons of television. What are we doing wrong, Shu? Like, like you said, how many, Alan, you've done how many seasons in how many years?
It's 7 seasons in 4 years.
Okay. I've done four seasons in 4 years. What's wrong with my career? Can you help me?
I will say that I've had a very strange career, because I pointed out to somebody that I have had movies produced in the last 5 decades. But my age wouldn't match. My age doesn't match that. But I've had movies produced in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s, and with Wrong Turn, it'll be 2020s. That's 50 years or 5 decades. Sorry, 5 decades of movies I've had produced. But I'm not 80 years old. So
guys, Alan is 78 years old. He's not 80. He's not 80, but he's 78. No,
Alan was 135 years old.
But hey, I just want to wrap and say, is it all right if we wrap, Sean?
Yeah, we should wrap. This has been illuminating, but go ahead, Shu.
I just want to wrap and say that two things. Number one, that your story is really a testament to what we talk about sometimes on this show, is that making a career in this business is not a sprint. It really is a marathon. And part of the marathon is not so much, you know, how fast you get out the gate or how your career might be moving at one particular time. It's really just about staying in and persevering until you get to the end, because you never know what's going to come back around. And I think that Star Trek example is such a great one for that. And the second thing I'll say is that, like, you I just want to give you a shout out personally, because you gave me a gift at the end of our time on the Vampire Diaries, which was, I still have, which is a crystal ball, and I keep it on my desk. And you wrote something in the card that I'm paraphrasing, but it basically said something like, this is a crystal ball so that when you want to dream about what's coming next in your career, you just put your hand on it and see it. And I thought that was such a special gift, and I still remember that. And occasionally I do utilize those instructions and amazing. Try to see my future in that crystal ball. So thank you, Alan. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. You are and do have an amazing career. You're going to do incredible things. I mean, when I met you, I said, that guy's going to do amazing things, and you are going to, and you already are.
Thank you for that.
All right, y'all. Well, unfortunately, after this riveting conversation, we have to wrap this up. We can't bend your ears forever. So we're going to go to our evergreen segment, how we like to end every single episode, where we tell you what not to do. Yes, y'all. It's a segment called Don't Do That Shit. So I would like to actually invite our guest of honor. If you would like to participate, if you have some advice on what people should not do, Alan, the floor is yours, bro.
All right. One thing that I feel people should not do is say their project is dead. Too many people I know will kill off a project that they wrote a spec script. They sent it out. They gave it to their agents, their reps, whatever. It went out into the marketplace and it died. You know, it did not sell. And they come back to me and they say, yeah, you know, I wrote the script and, you know, it didn't go forward. It's a dead project. It is not a dead project. I have taken scripts that have gone out in the marketplace, been optioned, re-optioned, didn't set up, didn't go forward, whatever. You bring that thing back in because something at its core spoke to you. You were willing to put your energy and your passion into writing it. It is still there. Change the names of the characters. Change the setting. Alter the time period. Do something to refresh it. You could change one character's name. That's a new script. It belongs to you. Do not let that project die because it went out and didn't sell on first blush. I have many projects that happened. I just recently had a movie on Netflix called Fracture. I wrote that script so long ago, I can't remember when I wrote it. It has so many lives. It went through Paramount Vantage. It went through Wonderland Sound and Vision. It went through so many companies, and you just keep pushing it. My agents, I don't know how many times they told me, it's done, put it in a drawer, I'm sorry. I was like, no, not giving up on it. I'm not talking about, you know, adapting a novel or something you're doing that's IP, but if it's something that you poured your heart and soul into for a pilot or for a feature, do not tell me or do not say that project is dead. It is never dead. At its core, there's a story that you wanted to tell, you had a passion to tell, and it's not dependent on this character's name or that character's name or even their gender or the time period. At its core was a truth you wanted to tell. Do not let that project die because someone else didn't have the vision at that moment to see it. It might be that at that moment. In 5 years, that project is suddenly valid or relevant, or people, a new administration has come into the, a new regime has come into the studio. Do not let the project die. Do not tell me your project is dead. Do not do that shit.
Love it. I mean,
that's great.
One day I'm going to go on to tell the detailed story of the movie that I have in post-production right now, which went out in Hollywood, sat for 10 years, and then got scooped up, bought, and produced. So I can totally co-sign that shit.
There you go.
That's great. That's a great one. That's a great one. Should I jump in and let you have the last one?
Sure. Yeah.
All right. I got a pretty simple one today, and actually that is a good descriptor, as you'll understand in a second, because my don't do that shit is, when in doubt, when you're crafting a script, screenplay, or television pilot, when in doubt, don't be complicated. When in doubt, be simple.
Preach.
A simple, as I was coming up, one sort of epiphany, I guess, that I had back when I would read a lot of scripts, either, you know, scripts that people, peers had written or scripts that were sort of out in the world, a practice that I've talked about before that I don't recommend, reading a whole bunch of scripts for a variety of reasons, which you can go back and listen to other episodes to find out. But back when I was doing that, one of the common themes that would come through is that a simple, well-told story was always better than a complicated, complex attempt at something that didn't really hit the mark. Maybe had some interesting elements, but just didn't hit the mark. The simple story almost always won. And so when in doubt, don't be complicated. Don't fear the simple, well-told story that is about a character who wants something and has an obstacle in his or her way to getting it. That's storytelling, and rely on those basic building blocks when in doubt.
Oh, man, I appreciate that. I love that one. I could add on to that, but I'll just let the simplicity of that don't do that shit live, because I think it's really true. I guess it's my turn.
Yes, sir.
All right. My don't do that shit for this week. Don't get obsessed with the abstract idea of good ideas. So many people who are new to writing or have never written at all think the most important aspect of a script is the idea. Oh man, I got a great idea. Oh, I'm going to tell you my idea, but can you sign a NDA because I don't want you to steal my idea, blah, 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 blah. Your idea sucks. It's not even really that important. What's important is execution. Again, for the people in the back, what's important is the execution of the script. That's where writers make their money, not with coming up with ideas. Now, don't get me wrong. If you have a great idea, of course, if you have five ideas and there's one that just seems to be a sparkling gem, write the one that's a sparkling gem. Of course, write the best idea. But don't think the idea is what makes the script work. You know, guys, I was watching some movies with my wife. My wife's favorite director is Alexander Payne. And we sat down and we watched the movie Sideways. It's a beautiful movie. It's one of my favorite movies in the past 20 years or so. It's not a great idea. I mean, it's sort of a nothing idea. It's about two guys who go to wine country for a bachelor week. I mean, is that a great idea? Does that jump off the page to you as a great idea? No. But because it's well executed, it's one of the dopest movies I've seen in recent memory. Moonlight. Is Moonlight a great idea? Not really. It's sort of like even hard to describe. It's not like a high concept idea that's so great. Oh, it's a great idea. I have a billion-dollar idea. It's not a billion-dollar idea. It became a billion-dollar idea when you put it in the hands of people who can really execute. So stop being obsessed with ideas. Stop thinking your ideas are what's going to make it, you know, make you pop. It's not. What's going to make you pop is doing the work and executing on the page, killing it on the page every single time. So for all y'all who are obsessed with ideas and always think that your ideas are what's going to get over, what's going to make you get over in the industry, don't do that shit. Stop.
That's a great one.
Perfect.
That's, yeah.
Fantastic. Sure, that's all we got. That's all we got, man. That's it. That's the end.
That's it for this episode. Why don't you take us out, Sherman? Thanks so much for joining us, Alan. We appreciate it.
Alan, we appreciate you so much coming on the pod. We look forward to following your career as it continues into 6, 7, 8 decades. Who knows? How many decades will Alan's career stretch? We don't know. We're going to watch with the rest of y'all. But Alan, seriously, thank you so much for coming on, man. This was a great conversation.
Thank you. This was a great, great opportunity. And I really appreciate it, you guys. Thank you for just having this podcast. I think it's invaluable to people to have it and to hear it. So thank you, guys.
So you guys have been listening to The Diversity Hires. You can find us across all social media at Div Hires Pod. I'm your host, Sherman Payne.
And I'm Shukri Hassan Tillman. This show is produced by the wonderful August K. Burton, also known as AKB. Big shout out to him. You can find us, as Sherman said, anywhere on social media. You can find the podcast anywhere podcasts are found. We really need you to subscribe and, most importantly, to share. We've got to pick up more and more listeners that want this fire advice and this, well, we don't do advice, this fire conversation and talk about screenwriting. So please, please, please share. You can find us at thediversityhires.com and write us anything you want us to talk about or just want to make a comment and tell us how great we are. That's great too. You can find us there, and we look forward to seeing you next week on the Diversity Hires. Bye-bye.